Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Conversations with me, your host, Scott Drummond. It's February, and that means the topic we're exploring is death. And diving deep into today's topic with me is Michaela. So Michaela is a relationship counselor working with couples and individuals who want to explore and work through their relationship challenges. And over the years, she's developed a personal and professional interest in the impact of bereavement and loss on the individual and their close relationships. And she's also a passionate advocate of the psychological benefits of decluttering and creating organized living spaces. So she set up The Tidy House, a business, just prior to the pandemic as a way to deliver that message around living and creating organized living spaces. And specifically in relation to the topic of death, she had to deal with the estates of her late parents. And in doing that, she came up with this concept of legacy decluttering, which is a service to support those having to deal with a loved one's belongings, and also to support those who want to start taking care of their clutter now so that their loved ones won't be left with an unnecessarily large burden. Michaela, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here talking about a favourite topic.
Yeah, you don't often get invites to openly talk about it. So it's nice to have spaces, I think, where this isn't a taboo topic, where we can just talk about the stuff that is on our minds.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a fascinating topic, but a lot of people are scared to look at it too closely, I think. Just that feeling of our own mortality creeps in. So yeah, I welcome the opportunity to talk to someone who's happy to travel that path.
Brilliant. And yeah, I mean, part of this inquiry for me, having these conversations and writing about death throughout February, is I think deep down, I really want us to live in a society where open conversations about loss, about grief, about bereavement, about death, help us to live with less anxiety during our life, help us to live more aligned with our values, more in connection with the people and the things that matter to us. So for me, this is a wider kind of desire, I guess, for us to have a better relationship with death.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what you said there about living by talking about it and facing it actually can help you feel less anxious about it. And definitely from my experience, you know, obviously in your intro, you were talking about the legacy decluttering. And I've got all my affairs in order. So the house is decluttered, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in a bit. I've got a will, all my paperwork's organized. And even though I'm not planning on going anywhere anytime soon, it actually gives me peace of mind just walking around day to day, just knowing that if anything did happen to me, less likely on lockdown, obviously, but if I got hit by a bus, that I'm not leaving a horrible mess on top of, you know, obviously the grief of me dying for my husband and son and wider family. So I can really relate to that thing of even the idea of actually facing up to this stuff, tackling it, and then you don't need to think about it. You can just get on living your life freely, which is just very liberating.
It's so great to hear, because you know the idea of legacy decluttering itself is I just think a brilliant idea. But I think what's so interesting to me is that this comes from a really deep personal experience, right? This isn't just a smart idea that you came up with because you spotted a niche in the market. This comes from your lived experience of what happens when there is a death or more than one death, and alongside this huge new world of kind of grieving, grief, loss, comes a huge tidal wave almost of logistical problems to solve at the time when we're probably least resourceful to do that. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what brought you to this space of realizing the power of legacy decluttering.
Yeah, no, sure. So when I was, I think 32, my mum died quite suddenly. So she'd been not feeling great for about a year. Doctors had just fobbed her off with, you know, nothing really. And then eventually we sort of pressed and she got a diagnosis. She had pancreatic cancer and she died within 3 weeks of her diagnosis. So obviously it was a huge shock. And my dad had was alive at the time and he had had MS for like many, many years. And so all eyes had been on my dad. He'd be in and out of hospital. And, you know, we all just assumed that my dad's days were limited. So it was even more of a kind of blind side that my mum was the first to go. She's only 65. And she lived with her partner. My mum and dad were separated, but very involved in each other's lives still. And she had taken on the running of a property, some rental properties that her and my dad had bought together. And so I was thinking about our conversation coming up today, and I was just thinking about this image that I have that kind of always to me kind of highlights the stressful nature of beyond like the actual loss of my mum, who I, you know, was super close to. Was she had this huge bunch of keys that were keys to all the different properties and all the different rooms and what have you. And because of the speed of her kind of rapid decline from her diagnosis, there wasn't any handover time. And, you know, we just focused on taking care of her and just not worrying about doing handover, obviously. But this massive bunch of keys just to me really symbolizes that feeling of, oh my goodness, like huge overwhelm. And we had to, I can't remember how many tenants she had, but like quite a lot. And we had to literally go through every single door and test every key until we found that key and we'd label it. And so that is just one small element of the estate that she left behind. And then obviously there were other things to sort out of hers. And then my dad died 8 months later. Sort of unexpectedly, like he hadn't been particularly ill beyond his normal MS levels, and he just died. And so we had to do it all over again, just like dealing with his property and all his belongings. And luckily I have my brother to help, but it's just very overwhelming. And then more recently, a really dear friend of mine from when I was, you know, at primary school, she lost her mum a few years ago and then her dad died very suddenly. Her siblings live abroad and so most of it was left to her, and we don't live close together anymore. So I had to, you know, my only option was to just offer support via the phone. But that's kind of the point that triggered me into thinking about doing the looking at legacy decluttering, because it was just sort of witnessing somebody go through that just mountainous task of a whole lifetime. You know, they raised their three children in that house. They were married for many, many years. It's just a monumental task. So it's kind of those experiences that led me to create it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm struck by, I mean, first of all, thank you for sharing, and also, like, what, you know, what a kind of overwhelming situation, you know, to lose your mum in that sudden way. And then, you know, I lost my mum to MS, and even though she had been sick for 20 years, in fact, when she died, she had just been discharged from the hospital, having had a relapse, and was deemed to be in remission. So we were sort of the, you know, it was, you know, we had the experience of her being in and out of hospital, but we thought she was actually, you know, coming out for a while. And so that came as a bit of a shock too. One thing that also really struck me is, first, it is almost, I don't know whether this is the case, but this distinction as well between the keys is such a kind of powerful image of the many responsibilities that we have. You know, each key is another, you know, it's not just a key to a door, it's a set of relationships, it's an email trail, it's all the many things involved in that key. And so I also wondered, you know, there's so much logistically and kind of physically that requires processing. And also in this process of, you know, looking at a whole house, you know, filled with, you know, the physical artifacts of life, of memories, how much emotional kind of processing could be involved in the legacy decluttering experience. So not just organizing objects and you know, deciding what to do with them, but also revisiting those memories and through that kind of, I guess, coming closer to the grieving process, in that process of spending time with objects, artifacts, and the relationships that they signify, whether that's also a kind of powerful grieving process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what moving into this sort of decluttering territory alongside the counselling, what I've was really struck by, I had an experience of this myself to a degree doing my own decluttering process, but, you know, supporting other people in their process and just realizing how powerful an object can be in terms of instantly transporting you to a time, a place, a memory, a feeling, a smell. It's really, really powerful. I kind of refer to them as gateways. And I think that is a huge part of the overwhelm, in particular doing the sort of legacy work. So in terms of if you're decluttering and sorting out the belongings of a loved one who's died, that there's two things going on. There's the kind of practical process of this stuff has to be sorted through and, you know, on the whole got rid of. You know, obviously you generally can't just take a whole house load of stuff into our own houses. So there's that kind of practical side of things, you know, the lifting, the carrying, the getting stuff down from the loft, the carrying of heavy books, you know, all that labor. But then there's, you know, all the memories that are associated with lots of those objects, which can really derail the practical process. So, you know, I remember my friend saying that she'd be doing something like, I don't know, sorting out some paperwork or whatever, and then she'd come across a piece of handwritten something of her, you know, one of her parents, and then that would stop her in her tracks and she'd, you know, feel the emotions that came up with that thing. And that's really exhausting. So part of what I was starting to develop for, you know, to sort of help people is a roadmap to try and keep people feeling like they can stay on track. And one of the ways is that you put aside, so really quickly, if you can, when you come across something that has particular emotional charge, you'd put that to one side. So let's say you're doing a bookcase and, you know, lots of the books are just kind of neutral to you. They don't have any specific significance. And then you find this special book that has emotional memories attached. Rather than stopping and opening, excuse me, the book, you just put it to one side in a sentimental pile, knowing you'll come back to that, knowing that you will honor it when you do come back to it. But at the moment, the task in hand is to clear this bookshelf. So that can be a helpful tool. Otherwise, you'll just be derailed every half an hour or so.
That just strikes me as such a brilliant practical kind of tip, right, for people to use, you know, who might be going through this process right now or thinking about going through it. And it also kind of brings up for me, I guess, this, you know, you can explain it more clearly to me, but the KonMari method too, and this process of kind of seeing objects as fundamentally potentially possessing emotional resonance, and then, you know, deciding what to keep based on the quality of that resonance. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about your training and how you bring this work to the legacy decluttering and to the rest of your life.
Yeah, sure. So the KonMari method came into my life about 6 years ago, and there's a book by Marie Kondo who developed this method. She's a Japanese decluttering guru, really. And I wasn't really looking for something like that, but, it, you know, sometimes things just come into your orbit and they demand your attention. So I bought the book and I started to read it and just completely fell in love with it. It made so much sense. And the central premise, this is just for decluttering your own house, your own things, is you hold every object you own, and there's a particular order in which you kind of move through the things you own. But you hold each item and you check to see if it sparks joy. If it does, you keep it. And if it doesn't, you thank it and you let it go and send it on somewhere else. And so I did our whole house, and actually my husband, Vince, who you know, came on board. And it was a huge undertaking. It took me probably a year. I had a little toddler at the time, so difficult to find the time. But it completely changed our lives. And I became quite evangelical about just the power of getting rid of clutter. And we had what I called the basement room of doom. So at the time, we lived in a three-story Victorian house, and we had this big old basement. And it became the dumping ground for dead relatives' things, baby stuff, you know, storing furniture for other people, stuff we didn't have room for. And it was an absolute mess. The rest of the house was really tidy, but this room was just like something from a Channel 4 documentary. It was awful.
It's the guilty secret, isn't it? I think I would be surprised if I didn't, if not every single person I knew had some nook and cranny, some room, some cupboard that's just jammed to the top with stuff that they just can't even look at the moment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, we have the expression out of sight, out of mind. It isn't out of mind. It nags away. You know it's there, even if it's not in your full consciousness. You kind of know, oh, one day I've got to sort out the attic or the garage or the shed or the basement or the storage unit. Worse, the storage unit, if you're paying crazy amounts of money, which I have done in the past, never again. So, yeah, so that's the central premise, is does it spark joy? And then really what you're left with is a hugely reduced amount of things. The things you have around you are things that you actively love and enjoy. Either they're beautiful or they're useful, or, you know, they truly are a kind of chosen item. And then your home feels more curated. You don't lose stuff. That's another big one is, you know, we just don't lose stuff anymore, whereas we used to lose stuff all the time and just be like, where's this, where's that? So that never happens now. We just know where keys, purse, you know, clothes, everything is, which is great. Lay your hand on a book for somebody, whatever it might be, you can find it. So that's great. And then with the legacy work, it's a bit different. It's not really just purely down to does it spark joy? Because that's maybe a bit harder to tune into, especially in the earlier days of grief. But nevertheless, it is about inviting the client to kind of notice in their body. So more somatically than in their head. We've got so many stories in our head of why we should keep something. You know, oh, that was my mum's favourite, whatever. I remember my mum had a collection of these sort of china teapot things, and luckily I kind of tuned in enough to know, no, that was her collection, that's not something I want in my home. But yeah, it's about also allowing or guiding people, not allowing, but guiding clients to be able to let go of the stuff that brings up really horrible memories. So I've had, I worked with a client where we came across some writing of someone who died, and it was very distressing. And, you know, we did quite a lot of work around that. And then there was a letting go process of that, of those belongings, because they really had a, I guess, a sort of toxicity to them that she didn't need to keep. And she could keep other things that had much happier memories attached. So yeah, I think I might have wandered off topic there. I don't know. But
No, not at all. And some of the things that were coming up for me as you were speaking is this strikes me as such a kind of interesting approach to the idea of attachment. Like, what do we become attached to? Why? And how does that serve us? Or what does that give us? And the KonMari method, and the legacy decluttering work, although separate and different necessarily, both have this aspect of a mindful approach to the things in our life, understanding what our relationship to them is, understanding what our attachment is. And I thought the example you gave of the China teapots collection is a brilliant one. I think so often we hold on to things from other people because I guess we're not ready to let them go. They serve as a kind of anchor point, as a way for us to continue that relationship. Mm. And sometimes that's not really our decision in a way. It's, you know, it's the emotionality of letting go at that time just isn't possible. I'm really struck as well by, and I think it opens up another topic, which is your profession, you know, your profession and how uniquely well suited you are to support people in this way because of your experience, your professional training as a counsellor. It hadn't occurred to me as much how traumatic the experience of going through a loved one's effects might be, and I know why that is. I think it's because I'm very privileged and fortunate to have a very positive relationship with the people in my life who have died, and therefore going through their effects largely obviously brings up sadness and loss and a sense of them not being there, and that, you know, I'm having to process that emotion. But it has never brought up a feeling of fear, for example, or triggered other like traumatic emotions. And that strikes me where your role as a counselor and your experience and your professional training must be incredibly valuable to the clients that you work with.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've been a counselor for, I think it's coming up 11 years. And I did my training with Marie Kondo and her team 2 years ago, I think. Time is a bit elastic, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
2 years or 2 months ago. I think it was a couple of years ago. So obviously I came already having had those years of counselling training, and I had a sense of, I think the two businesses would sit well alongside each other. I felt like, you know, there needs to be a kind of authenticity in my endeavours and a kind of, you know, something that feels simpatico with my work as a counsellor. So this definitely had that feeling about it. But it was only really once I started working with actual clients and just realising the stories that are told. And what can come up, and like you say, you know, trauma can surface through holding an object. And I guess there's also something around, and it's a bit like what happens in the counselling room, there's this almost a kind of sacred space, which you may have experience of in your own work. When you're really holding space for somebody and you're really paying attention to them and you're there for them, you're there in service to them, this isn't about you, the kind of practitioner. I think there's a kind of a charge that happens in the room. And so maybe that allows some of those feelings to surface more readily than if they were just, I don't know, doing a sort out on a Saturday, you know, on their own, maybe. And so, for sure, I've felt very grateful for the training that I've had and the experience I've had of sitting with people going through different difficult emotions, to not feel overwhelmed, to feel I can hold them safely and confidently. And I think that's probably then what kind of led my interest in looking to work in that sort of legacy decluttering field, just because it is a highly charged emotional time for somebody. And I think just seeing, there was one particular piece of work I did where, which started off as just a piece of standard house decluttering. But, you know, pretty quickly we realized there was this big bereavement work to be done within that process. And just seeing the transformation for that particular client, the liberation from a lot of, you know, just difficult stuff over the years, really struck me. And I wasn't expecting it to be quite so powerful. I'm super grateful to have that kind of background as well.
I think the way you described the counselling room is really important. It's I think the word sacred gets used a lot in different ways, but I actually think this is very true of these sorts of spaces. I think it's a space where everything is allowed. Whatever emotions are there are free to kind of express themselves. And that is not true of almost any of the other spaces we find ourselves in. Certainly not with other people. It's often, you know, even with those we feel closest to, because the nature of the relationship that we might have had, there may be some emotional states or feelings that just really aren't that easily expressed, even around our closest loved ones. And so having this kind of container, I know that word's often used, where everything is allowed is, you know, I think the great gift of counseling. And yeah, I experience it in coaching too, albeit often with less, I would say less traumatic areas to deal with, coaching often being more focused perhaps on forward-looking growth rather than processing of deeper emotional you know, states. But absolutely, that space being, you know, sacred is, you know, I tell that to my clients all the time. It's, you know, this is, and sometimes, you know, I use the analogy of it's like a laboratory of sorts. You can be free to try whatever experiments you want in this lab. You know, there's no judgment. It's a space where you can fail epically, you know, where you can try some brand new version of yourself on, and play around in that new suit, that new identity, that different perspective, that new sense of connection to yourself that you're still, you know, feeling around. Is this right for me? You can try that on in the coaching space in a way that is, you know, very freeing and, you know, perhaps builds confidence or courage to then take 1% of that out with you into, you know, the rest of your life and try it on out there too as a means of exploring, you know, the edges of your identity and where you want to go with that.
Oh, I love that. I think that's great. I love that idea. It feels really kind of permissive and playful. I love that idea. Just it's, you can experiment. It's a, you know, you encourage it. It's definitely something about the you know, the practitioner, the coach, the counselor, setting the tone for how to use that time. And to say, you know, I kind of want to see you fail because you're trying, you know, that's, we're not going to be disappointed if the experiment doesn't work. We can celebrate that failure and see what information it gives us. So that didn't work. What does that tell us that will work? And I think although my counseling work by its nature, so I just specialize in relationship therapy. So I'm either working with couples or individuals, but always with a relationship focus. But of course, everything else comes into that because, you know, we're just humans. And so you might be coming to talk about your relationship, but you've had a bereavement or you've had a trauma or whatever. So obviously we work with everything, but the kind of primary reason for someone getting in touch with me over, you know, another counselor is because the focus is initially on the relationship, certainly in the beginning. And so although it's, you know, it's kind of heavier work, it's perhaps sometimes less playful. I don't mean that in a kind of derogatory sense. I love the idea of your work is about future and experimentation. But, you know, sometimes we have to wade through some difficult stuff in my work before we can get to that point. But just linking in with that idea of anything goes in your sessions. And likewise with my clients, it's about, we can talk about the unspeakable in this room, and it doesn't mean we're committing to it. So if I'm working with a couple and there's a question mark about, you know, possibly the relationship's come to an end and we need to look at separation, we can have the conversation together, which can be quite difficult for a couple to do on their own because it feels like they're committing to it. So if you raise it with your partner, just say, I think we should look at what it might be like if we separated, it can just feel like you're actually stating that as an intention. And so it is a space where you can look at that. And what I always say is we're not committing to this. We're just looking to see what it would feel like. And it may be that you look at it and you think, we absolutely don't want that. Now we've looked at it, we know we don't want that. And that gives you the impetus to really work hard at rebuilding the relationship. Or conversely, we can look at it and a couple can say, actually, it doesn't feel as daunting as I feared it would. It does seem like a better option. So I love those sort of parallels between the space we hold for clients, where you can kind of speak the stuff that you might not speak to those around you.
And I'm struck by a word that came up for me as you were describing that, which I think perhaps links the two, is this idea of choice. Is that in that room and at that time, the person has choice. You know, they get to, you know, it's a space where they can look, become aware of, like explore whatever topics, you know, come to them and need to be explored, and don't have to feel committed to them. I love that idea that they have this choice to make. And we help guide them to connect with themselves and with each other in a way that they can make that choice mindfully and, you know, and kind of commit to the choice when they're ready, rather than feeling like they have to commit to it because they're discussing it. And, you know, I'm also just struck by, so one thing that resonated is you talked about, you know, your relationship counselor, and inevitably, you know, you see people and, you know, other things are going on in their life. That's so true of the coaching work that I do too. You know, often people will come and they might say, oh, we want to, you know, I'm looking at getting a promotion at work, or I'm struggling in this leadership role, or whatever it is. But in truth, the answers to that inquiry are found throughout their life rather than usually specifically in one area. And so I think, you know, these are all doors to doing the internal work, or going on the inner adventure, as I sometimes call it. I'm struck by, there is a real distinction, I think, between counseling and coaching. I see them as on a spectrum, you know, and there's definitely work I'm sure you do in your relationship counseling that can be more playful, or potentially can have those elements of forward looking, etc. And likewise in coaching, there's often times where we have to stop and sort of say, okay, there's clearly something else here which we're not talking about. And then we might kind of go backwards to go forwards a little bit. I'm struck by how in coaching we often hold this, it's not a truism, but it's perhaps a bias towards seeing the client as kind of whole, resourceful, capable, you know, but a bit stuck and maybe a bit lost as to what to do next. And that potentially in counseling, there are moments when clients really aren't that resourceful for very, very obvious reasons. And need more, you know, from their guide at that time. Just to kind of bring us back to this idea of the experiment, simply because a friend recently asked me this question. He said, if you were giving advice to someone in their early 20s, which, by the way, I'm not prone to doing, because I'm sure I was given lots of advice in my early 20s. I'm pretty sure I didn't take any of it. he asked, if you were giving advice to someone in their early 20s, what are some ways they could invest in serendipity? And he described serendipity as smart luck. And I had a bit of a think about this, and I guess I was thinking about coaching too, but the answer I came up with, or the, I guess it's advice, is embrace experimentation with life as your laboratory. Design experiments that are inherently fun. Run lots of experiments. Have lots of fun. Gather results and use what you learn to design even more fun experiments, ideally with others, and then repeat that process. And actually, in this conversation, I really like the kind of leaning towards fun and joy, because I think that is a choice. And I know I'm prone to getting quite heavy in general. But in this conversation, what I also find really important, and it's, I think, doesn't get talked about enough as well, is that life is not just the fun bits. Life is not, you know, getting over the obstacles of grief or of loss or of heartache or of pain so that we can do the proper living bit, which is all fun and joyful, and, you know, that life is all of this stuff. So were I to revisit that answer, I think I would just maybe take out the fun and just talk about, you know, experiences, you know, design experiments, you know, and then look at the results. Because I do think, and this is a particular bias of mine, but I do think that alongside the very kind of challenging emotional territory we often have to traverse when we're dealing with death, and there's a lot of that, you know, and grief, grieving, even dealing with illness and sickness, is something I'm sure we can talk about too. Alongside all of that, there are, as I see it, great gifts in that experience. If we're open to, you know, working through the mass of emotions. I'm now at a point, for example, in my relationship with my mum, having been, you know, having passed away, being dead for 12 years, I'm now at a point where I see great gifts in this experience of grieving, you know, where I notice, for example, my ability to support others who are experiencing loss is greatly increased as a result of my own experience. So I can now, with the benefit of some time and some space and with a lot of work really on those emotions, I can recognize some of the gifts that I've gained through this experience. And so, yeah, I think maybe I like in some ways the bias towards having fun with our experiments, but I wouldn't want it to turn people away from death and loss and bereavement as really important learning grounds. I love this distinction that's sometimes made between, I think Philippa Perry makes this distinction actually, which is she talks about dealing with and feeling with. Often when we're talking about, you know, especially when we're talking about death and what we might term difficult emotions, we talk about dealing with them, which is kind of about like getting through them and putting them aside and not having to look at them again.
Mm.
And this distinction with feeling with them is really like sitting down alongside our grief, alongside our suffering, alongside our fear, our worry, and, you know, taking time there to feel into that space, you know, not rushing through it as though the, you know, the objective is to get to the outcome, which is not experiencing it or not feeling it, but instead accepting that the process will take as long as it needs to take. And the job right now is to feel into it when we are ready for that and when we feel resourceful enough. And I love that distinction.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's great. I love that. And I don't think the business of grief is ever done, much as we'd like to think it is, because certainly in my experience, so my mum's been gone same roughly the same amount of time as your mum. And so much has happened in both our lives since then. And so I feel like there are conversations that I would love to have with her that I could never have predicted I'd want to have when I was 30 or 32. So since my mum died, I got married, I've had a child, you know, when I was pregnant, I had a great pregnancy, and I remember her saying she had great pregnancies. But there were loads of things I would have loved to ask her, which I never would have thought to ask her when I was 30 and, you know, not in any way thinking of having children. So I think there's a kind of revisiting of the loss when you remember, oh, I'd love to share this with you, or I'd love to know what your take is on this. With me setting up the tidy house, my dad was a really good businessman and did lots of kind of public speaking, and I never asked him about that stuff. And, you know, I've started having conversations with him in my mind, just like, okay, Dad, right, I do actually need you now. I haven't had a super good relationship with my dad since he's been gone, as in we weren't mega close when I was growing up. I'm sure that would pain him for me to say that, but we weren't super close. He was away quite a lot. But now I feel like, oh, okay, I'm in a period of my life where I'm doing more speaking. I'd really love to be able to have that conversation with him. And I think we can, you know, I'm not saying necessarily on a kind of in a spirit realm sort of way, although for some people, you know, that would feel like, you know, that would be true for them. But I think we internalize them. And so we do have a sense of what they might tell us. So I think we can tap into that.
I'm struck actually by, this is a really interesting territory to come to discuss with you, because you know, one of your hats that you wear is as a relationship counselor. And I often talk about the last 12 years as me trying to, I guess, understand or come to terms with perhaps what does a relationship with my mum look like and feel like now that she's physically not here. So I still, you know, I still have a relationship with her that hasn't changed, but the circumstances, the kind of, I guess, well, the first and foremost, the tangibility, like I can't see, touch, feel, you know, smell, the sensory realm is kind of now gone. But I still have a relationship with her. I still think about her. I still talk to her. She still, I think about her in certain situations. And I think, I love the distinction you made as well, or the observation about, you know, as we grow older and we experience more of life, we get asked more questions. Yeah, you know, life is this machine for asking us questions, and we get to answer them if we choose to. And I feel like the older I get, the more questions I have, because life keeps asking me new questions. And I would love to have, I guess, this wise advisor, somebody who I know I would share some similar opinions with too, on my shoulder to ask those questions to. So I do. But obviously, the answers, you know, I don't know where the answers come from. Perhaps it's my imagined version of what mum might have said. But yeah, I'm curious about, you know, how do we continue to relate to somebody post-mortem? This is a, you know, it's a topic that I know personally I've been trying to explore. You know, I've done all sorts of things. I've created little rituals. So this year, I think for the first year, I really created a kind of a very mindful, bespoke remembrance ritual for mum. And that was really in response to the fact that we're in lockdown. And I have three siblings. And usually on this, on the anniversary of mum's death, we would either be together or we would find a way to kind of spend a bit of time together. Not necessarily in deep remembrance, but just hang out together. You know, we're fortunate that we have a strong relationship, and this is something that we share and has bonded us together as well. But this year that wasn't possible, so I ended up recording this like grounding meditation, having and then having a sort of suggested small activity for us each to do at the same time on the same on the day, which was lighting a Yahrzeit remembrance candle. And then reciting a few words. And it was, you know, to some extent, these are all kind of quite artificial activities we engage in. But I found it really powerful to be in relationship with mum, but also in relationship with my siblings at that time. Yeah, and I'm really curious at what are other ways, if, again, this is, you know, this is a small ritual I designed, but what are other ways that we can continue our relationship with those people when they're no longer physically there with us? And I'd be really curious to hear your view on this as somebody that that works with the idea of relationship in a professional capacity.
Yeah, and I love that idea of connection that you created. And I will answer your question, but I think just that thing about you coming together, not physically together this year with your siblings, and it's something I've been very curious about with people who've lost people during the pandemic. And so funerals have taken on a different shape. I've had clients who've been bereaved in the time that we've been working together. So I've been, you know, involved in supporting them through that as well. And it's just as an aside, because I'll come back to how we can have more, my thoughts on how we can continue to have a relationship. But I've always thought, oh gosh, how awful for people who've lost someone during this particular time where they can't have that big celebration. I know with my parents, I was very comforted, although the funerals, because I was with both my parents when they died. So I didn't super need a funeral for me, because I felt like I'd really done my goodbyes. But I was very comforted by the the turnout that they had, you know, to see how many people were also, you know, super sorry that they weren't here anymore. So I assume people would feel they've missed out, but I've actually heard, and so I'm sure some people will feel they've missed out on that this time around, but I've also heard people saying it was a relief not to have to host a great big thing, and that they just came with, you know, 8 close family members and they did something really simple afterwards, you know, or I'm not even sure what, you know, there's all different restrictions over the period of the pandemic, but that it's actually been a relief not to have to host a big funeral. So it's interesting about that. Sometimes we want our grief to be shared and witnessed, and sometimes we don't. Just to pick up on what you were saying really about that ritual with your siblings, that has been important for you to have a sort of shared remembrance. So, yeah, I love that. But yeah, in answer to thoughts on how people can make a relationship with someone after they've died, for me, it's, well, there's a couple of things actually when I think about it. So one of them is I would drop in to, I guess, to my heart. So if I had a question, or like when I got married, I remember wondering, so that was, when did I get married? 2010. So that was only 3 years after my mum had died. And I felt fine. And we kind of decorated our own wedding. We did it quite homespun. And I knew she would have loved it. And I thought, oh, am I going to have some kind of breakdown because she's not here? And I didn't. I was fine. But I did feel a connection to her. I did feel I could picture her, the language she'd have used about how we'd decorated the wedding, and you know, I did the flowers, and it was all very kind of rough and ready because I'm not a florist. And I could just imagine the language she'd have used. I could sort of hear her voice, and so I felt almost like she was there because I could just picture her reaction. But I think also I would drop into my, you know, more of a sort of heart space. And if I wanted to connect, I would be trying to get out of my head and just into a place of more feeling. And yeah, just kind of, I think when you go into, it's a slightly sort of meditative state, so you're not forcing the answers. It's amazing what can come up that feels like it comes from nowhere. And like you were saying, of course it absolutely could just be coming from our Rolodex file in the back of our minds of all the things they've ever said to us, and you know, on a kind of unconscious level we can retrieve some of that. But I've definitely had experiences where I've a couple of times where I've just felt like, wow, that answer came and it felt out of nowhere. And I don't really mind where it comes from. It's just comforting. So yeah, I'd say for people to kind of drop in to that heart level and get out of their heads, and just wait to hear and see if there is an answer that comes. Because I do believe we have internalized their voices. And you know, we can take comfort, and I think we can tune into what would they say, what would they do.
Yeah, and what strikes me is, you know, we do this already with people that are not passed away, right? Yeah. You know, we might find ourselves in a situation and think, oh, what would my best friend do? You know, well, when we access that sort of, like, I guess it's almost like an external intelligence, but we source it internally, you know, and we sort of think to ourselves, oh, what might they do? And I love this focus on dropping into the heart too, because this question of where do we hold memory, you know, I've become increasingly interested in neuroscience over the last little while. And there's a great benefit to kind of the advances being made around neurobiology and neuroscience and the science of feeling and emotion, these sorts of things. And yet what I'm struck by when you talk is also just, sometimes it just feels a certain way within you, you know, and it's a felt sense. And, you know, we've touched a couple of times now, you talked a little bit about the somatic aspect, noticing somatically in the body what's needed. And I feel like this is one of the great gifts of experiencing counseling or coaching or any other sort of modalities, you could call them, or just any other kind of ways of practicing that put us in touch with our body and the wisdom that sits there. You mentioned meditation. I've been swimming quite a bit in the sea recently, and I always find, you can't really be in your head too much when you're in the sea. It just, it literally takes your breath away, and then you feel like, right, I'm right here. I can feel the tingling. And that isn't, it's not some sort of Spartan desire to punish myself. What I love about it is that you're not in your head at all in that place, and you're very present, very kind of in the moment there, because you sort of have to be. It's very difficult to go mind wandering too much when sensationally you're very stimulated in that way in the present. And I'm actually reminded of there's a book I've been reading called Immortality by Dr. Stephen Cave. He's a Cambridge philosopher, and he talks about the four narratives of immortality, the ways in which, as I describe it, we sort of distract ourselves from death. And the ones he cites are physically kind of prolonging life. So this is everything from the Holy Grail through to anti-aging creams. Then there's the resurrection narrative. This is the idea, that we die, but we are born again in the same body. So obviously Jesus, but we can talk as well about Frankenstein and the sort of myth that science can reanimate us in a way that, so we'll, yes, we'll die, but we'll come back. The third is the soul. And I think this is, as somebody who's kind of feels very closely drawn to Buddhism, this idea of something continuing, whether it's a consciousness, whether it's a soul, or, the self in some way, some ineffable aspect of ourself that continues on. And the last is legacy, which is, our great deeds or our genetic legacy as well. Throughout this book, Cave kind of, it's a brilliant, really entertaining read, actually, I'd say as well. It sounds like it would be incredibly heavy, but he makes it light enough, that spans civilizations and all sorts of cultures, to look at how these four recurring narratives sort of dominate the way that we don't deal with death, in a sense, or we don't spend time with death. And what I was really curious as I was reading the book is, like, okay, so if these four don't work, right, the evidence to suggest that we can prolong life indefinitely is not currently very good, as everyone seems to be dying. So resurrection feels difficult. The argument he makes around it is that, in fact, how do we ensure that the person that's deceased and the one that is risen again are really the same person? So Frankenstein's monster is made up of parts. If we were to do a kind of cryogenic freezing of somebody and then we brought them back to life, to what extent would that be the same person? So this is an argument around resurrection that he finds difficult to square. The soul is a challenging narrative, because it implies that there is something that is that lives on beyond the body dying. And one really interesting kind of example he gives, not to refute it so much, because I don't think he's in the business of sort of telling people that what they believe is wrong. I think he's just exploring it from this philosophical perspective. But he says with the soul, when we get knocked unconscious, the lights go out. There isn't some bit that kind of continues to go. So our consciousness doesn't survive getting knocked unconscious. And then when we come back into consciousness, there's often a blank, there's a space that we don't remember. And so he uses this as an inquiry to sort of say, like, why should we believe that after death, with the death of the brain and the body, should this consciousness live on if it can't survive being knocked on the head? And, I'm not here to say whether that's true or not. I'm just presenting his argument. And then with legacy, he raises this question, like, yes, okay, there's a cultural legacy we might leave, which is, the artifacts we leave behind, paintings, poems, music, career, And then there's the biological legacy, you know, our offspring or even ancestral sort of worship. And he says, but to what extent can we really say that what lives on in us is, you know, is that person? It's more like the memory of that person, or genetically it's 50% at best of that person if we're talking about our children. Mm-hmm. So he has these kind of ways that he explores these four kind of meta narratives that he says are really about us not spending time with the inevitability of death. And then I was, you know, as you read the book, you're sort of thinking to yourself, okay, so what's the answer? Mm-hmm. We're always looking for that answer. And I was really struck towards the end of the book. It's perhaps no great shock to reveal the end. So I hope this doesn't ruin it for people. Spoiler alert, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what he concludes. He concludes that we need wisdom to come to terms with our mortality and carry on regardless. And you know, in a way, that's kind of why I want to have these conversations, as I want us to explore how we can come to terms with and be with our mortality, with death, with this very natural part of life, and carry on, you know, not let it kind of dominate us through anxiety or dominate us through abstraction or distraction, right? You know, like you said, you know, out of sight and out of mind might sound great, but it isn't actually true.
Mm-mm.
And so he cites, Cave sort of cites is he chooses three things. And I like the way he does it. He doesn't really propose these as answers, but there's a logical kind of unraveling of what he's been talking about. And there's three things he says we should maybe focus on. So he says we should balance our focus on ourselves with a focus on others. We should balance our focus on the future with a focus on the present. And we should balance our focus on avoiding threats with a focus on what is good in our life. And so I sort of, you know, I very crudely take these to be focus on others, which is about mutuality or reciprocity or about giving. So charity almost could come in here. Having a focus on the present for me feels a lot like mindfulness and being present in the moment and realizing that that's where life happens, not in the past or in the future, but in fact in the moment. And then this balancing, avoiding threats with what's good in our life, this is really gratitude, you know. And so I think it would be a bit crude to suggest that the answer is, you know, mutuality or community, mindfulness and gratitude. But those three practices certainly feel like very strong ways for us to be with death and to be with bereavement. Whether or not they solve this thing, I think is not really the question, because again I bring it back to, I think, Philippa Perry saying we're not really here to deal with this. It's about feeling into it, you know. I'm having the wisdom to experience mortality, to truly contemplate it and to carry on, you know, without it, you know, dominating our lives. So yeah, so you know, getting in the sea strikes me as ticking at least one of those boxes, which is being present, being really, really present, not too much in the future. And in fact, when I go in the sea with friends, one thing we always practice is we dunk ourselves under the water, which currently right now is excruciating. I have to say, it's cold out there. But you dunk yourself under it, and when you come up, you say what you're grateful for.
Oh,
so it's like it's you know, I mean, ritualistically it looks like rebirth, right? you come up gasping for air and, you know, with a slight amount of brain freeze, but focusing on gratitude. And so I think, you know, thinking about the ritual that I designed, you know, that was really about focusing on others, you know, connecting with my siblings, being focused on the present moment as much as possible. So some of the words we repeated were not just about, you know, memories of mum, but also giving thanks for another day of life. So kind of remembering, you know, yes, kind of taking a moment of remembrance, thinking back to a memory of mum, that sort of thing, but also placing it within the context of gratitude and present gratitude. You know, what do we have to be grateful for in our life right now? I like where Cave is heading with this, because it speaks a little bit to this question about what is it that we can do that can support us to turn towards this very difficult topic, a topic that is still culturally quite taboo as well. And how can we be with the topic skillfully or usefully or emotionally in a healthy way? And how can we support others to do the same?
Yeah, for sure. And I think he, obviously haven't read the book, I've just got your synopsis of it, but...
Sorry, Stephen Cave, if you're listening, I've probably done a horrible job of summarizing, but the best I could do.
But he's, those kind of three central conclusions that he comes to, I think are in alignment with just living a good life. You know, you're thinking of others, you're being in the present moment, which, as you said, that is actually all there is the present. The past has gone and the future is yet to happen. And, you know, we know that there are neurological benefits to having an active practice around gratitude. And so what I take from that is we don't know. So where he's saying when you get knocked unconscious, you don't remember it, and so your soul doesn't have a memory of that. And yet there are other people who will tell stories of, you know, their near-death experiences or whatever, and their experience is something different to what he's describing. And, you know, I always just personally, I don't have a kind of religious faith. So I just kind of think, well, we don't know. I think for me, the worst sort of worst case scenario is in the same way that we don't remember life before we were born. And that's not distressing. I kind of think, well, that might be what happens. And then beyond that, there could be a whole host of amazing things that happen. And we just won't know till we get there. But my experience of being with my parents when they both died, so I'm really fascinated by that transition. You know, I think I have a bit of a morbid fascination. So when I hear about somebody who's died suddenly, I don't know, with social media and what have you, you know, people, you can look at someone's Facebook account and think, oh my gosh, you know, just yesterday they posted about their new trainers and little did they know that they would be dead tomorrow. And I'm fascinated by that transition point between being alive and being dead. And I've witnessed it in both my parents. And all I can say is there is this difference. I know it sounds obvious, but there is this difference between them alive and them dead. I know that kind of sounds obvious, but there's something you can't quite put your foot on. It's like the essence of them. So when my mum died, as we kind of, you know, cried for a few moments or whatever we did, when we left her, you know, left the room and went home, I didn't feel like I was leaving my mum behind on any level. I mean, obviously you want her body to be respectfully dealt with. But there wasn't a sense for me of, oh gosh, I'm leaving my mum here. My mum had gone. What you make of that, I don't know. I don't know what I make of it, but the essence of her had kind of evaporated from her body, and it no longer felt like it was my mum.
That is completely my experience too.
Really?
Yeah. 100%. It was the only way I can describe it is sort of uncanny. You know, it's sort of it's not disturbing in a way, but it's just you just know it to be true.
Yeah.
And so I remember it was very early in the morning and we were called. In fact, between dad and mum, they must have had a sense that this was going to be the night, because dad said, oh, listen, I'd really like to have this time with mum. And it might help. I mean, when I think back, I really think, I think it's a remarkable approach to take, and I'm really grateful for his sort of emotional connection at that time. But, you know, I think he said, you know, I think it's hard for her to let go. With us all here. And whether or not that's true, you know, there's no way to verify that. But sure enough, what had been a kind of 4 or 5 days of us being on rotation and each having moments with her on her as she lay dying, you know, moments of clarity, moments of connection, and also just spending time in the room, you know, as she was sedated.
Mm.
We all went home that night, and then we got a call very early in the morning. I actually don't remember the time, but I guess it must have been around 4, something like that.
Mm.
It probably would have been to say that Mum had passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we all sort of got into our clothes and everything and made our way down to the hospital again. And it was quite an eerie experience anyway. And I don't mean that in a sort of in a negative way. I mean just eerie and uncanny. It had snowed, and it had snowed quite a lot. And that, you know, I mean, yes, it snows in the UK every now and then, but I mean, there was a really thick blanket of snow. Right. And when we woke up at night, it must have been, I looked this up actually, it wasn't a full moon by any stretch, but it was a half moon at least, but it was bright. Mm. I remember waking up, and because the snow was reflecting the moonlight and it felt very bright. So getting down to the hospital and then going into the room and being able to sit by her bedside and sort of say a few last words when she'd already passed, I knew she wasn't there.
Mm.
I mean, it was her, 100% it was her. And mm. She looked no different to the way she had looked the evening before when I saw her last.
Mm.
But I knew she wasn't there. It was comforting, and it was a special moment. But I 100% knew that my mum wasn't there.
Yeah.
The person I knew her to be, the connection, the felt sense of a connection, the presence. You know, we talk about this thing of when someone walks into a room, their presence, you know, is felt. Mm. That wasn't there. You know, and I just, if you'd asked me what that felt like while she was alive, I'm not sure I could have told you what her presence was. I could have described characteristics she had or attributes or whatever. But this idea of a presence is quite difficult to pin down. But I knew it wasn't there. And I just... I didn't have to, I didn't look for that. I didn't, you know, have a preconception that that might be the case. As soon as I was in the room, I knew something was missing, and it was her.
Mm.
And yeah, I actually love, you know, where we've come to, because actually, we don't know.
Yeah. We don't know.
none of us know. And, you know, just before we clicked go live on this conversation, I think that's perhaps where we were. You know, one of the great things about these conversations is there isn't an answer.
Mm.
There's no definitive kind of final, this is the way that we make sense of this. And so it feels very right that we've found ourselves at a place in the conversation where we say we don't know. I just wanted to say a huge thank you, Mikola, for sharing your experiences of death, bereavement, in such a connected way, and also sharing your professional expertise and your experience around legacy decluttering, relationship counselling. It strikes me that there are hugely valuable ways for us to be around death and to mm-hmm. be with those who are experiencing death. And it just reminds me that we don't have to go through this stuff on our own. It can be something that we work together with other people around us to feel into it in a really useful and a kind of nurturing way. So I just wanted to say a massive thank you for this conversation.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me to have it with you. I think it's just so great to talk about it. And, you know, you just realize there's actually just so much to say about it. But yeah, I like where we ended up, where we don't know. And if we go with your chap, who's, was it Stephen Cave?
That's right, yeah.
Then while we don't know, we can just get on with the business of living a really good life and being connected to the present, and just hedge our bets that way. We might have a lovely surprise at the end, or who knows?
I live love well. That. I look forward to the lovely surprise, whatever it is. Meeks, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I look forward to listening to more of the upcoming episodes.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
And you.
Bye.